Yes, my name is Ian Warden. I am the LRAM coordinator at Fort Drum, and I'll be talking about reestablishing grass on undisturbed sandy sites at Fort Drum. And again, if anybody has any questions while I'm going along, feel free to put your hands up. I think it's easier to discuss things there instead of having to go back and forth and stuff like that. Okay, my agenda, we'll do a little introduction for Fort Drum, some basic facts. Then we're going to identify the problem. I have a few slides that will show what we are dealing with. Our objectives for reestablishing grasses, our solutions, lessons learned, and I'll be doing the lessons learned as I go along, and at the end we'll have questions. Okay, Fort Drum is a military installation, Army installation in northern New York. It's only about an hour north of Syracuse. It is the home of the 10th Mountain Division, one of the most deployed divisions in the Army. It's 107,000 acres. That includes cantonment, training area, and main impact areas. Vegetation types, it ranges from forested all the way down to grasslands. There's two basic soil types, I guess. Two-thirds of it is a silty loam. And to tell you the truth, I wish all of Fort Drum was like that, because they can do just about anything they want and it revegetates itself, you know, on its own. The other third is a outwashed sand, which is somewhat excessive drainage and very droughty, along with low organic matter and low nutrients, makes it very difficult to reestablish grass on those sites. Just for those who don't know, the LRAM program, besides revegetation, we also do training area reconfiguration. That's basically under vegetation management. We mow, we herbicide, we prescribe burn areas to keep it open for training. And speaking about training, a wide range of training on Fort Drum. Anything from ranges, 9mm pistols, up to aerial gunnery ranges. Right now, as you all know, with the conflicts in Afghanistan, there's a lot of urban training and stuff like that. But that's the most important thing, is training. And with these lands, if they degrade, that means the units cannot train on those lands, so we have to be able to get them back up to a vegetated state quickly as possible in order to keep the training going. So identifying the problems. This here, you know, is a typical open grassland area. But once a unit comes in, if they're digging fighting positions, defilade positions, or whatever, it can be very destructive, very disturbing. I don't know if you can see, but that's Tony standing in the middle of that one defilade position there. Yeah, he's a very photoshopped it in, right? Same thing here. This would be used as a bivouac site. The vegetation, the trees, are used as a concealment to hide the tents and stuff. But after a unit is done, you know, it's very disturbed. Another site is the Chinook, a CH-47 helicopter. Heavy lift, tremendous rotor wash there, but under a vegetative cover, it's no problem. But if we lose the vegetation, we got a lot of dust, and that's a safety hazard to the crews and to the equipment. So our objectives, first of all, is to establish a method to rapidly revegetate these areas. Second was to find a native species that would be able to hold up, vegetate quickly, but also hold up to the traffic. You know, that would be whether it's foot, or helicopter or mechanized, so it stays in a long time. And the next one was utilized in-house resources. So the first one, to revegetate an area. As you saw in that one picture with the dug-in positions, normally an engineer unit would dig those for a unit, the unit would use it, the engineer group is supposed to come back and smooth it all out. Sometimes they do a good job, sometimes they don't. So again, the first thing is site prep. We try to get all the ridges out and keep it all smooth, and therefore you have a better area to revegetate, especially when you're using like a no-till seeder. It'd be a lot nicer to pull one of those across here than if you're jumping over 2 or 3 foot berms. The next thing was a quick way to stabilize the site. And so we have a very excessive amount of cow manure in northern New York because we have a lot of dairy up there. I think the first thing we tried was right out of a manure spreader. That didn't work so well. I think it was an uneven coverage. The problem of transporting that to Fort Drum, because it typically, you know, isn't hauled in a dump truck. The farmer wouldn't do that. He would just put it in his manure spreader and go out and spread it. So what we did was we found a farm that would digest it. That's where they put the manure into either an open pit or a container, add water, let it sit, digest a little bit. But it's also easy to transport. This stuff comes to us in tractor trailer loads. They put it into these little spreaders, and they can easily get around and spread it on the affected surface. The manure does several things. First, it adds a little moisture. It actually stabilizes the sand right then and there, and it also tends to make the temperature, the microclimate of the area, more conducive to growing plants. Yes?
Are there costs associated with that other than the obvious transportation costs? I mean, does the farmer charge you for his manure?
They do charge us. Because again, a lot of them have excess, you know, because they want to use it on their own fields, is what they like to do. But yeah, they do charge us an amount. And again, we also don't have that equipment on Fort Drum or the tractor trailers. So, and also it's I wouldn't say it's big business, but you'll see a lot of truckers around there that have tractor trailers that just transport. And to tell you the truth, on a lot of these open fields, they actually drive the tractor trailers out there with these same type of spouts on them, spraying them out. They don't transfer it into a smaller unit like this, but which is obvious because we wouldn't be like a tractor trailer out there to get stuck. So the other thing is we normally do a soil sample, and that will tell us how much lime and fertilizer that we should put down also. Then a no-till seeder, very simple. You know, you put in your mixer, drive it around. We've also used the same technique with a hydroseeder, and we use this in a more sensitive area, such as if there's an archaeological site, and that we can't get the big equipment in. We don't use the liquid cow manure, but again, with the mulch that's added to it, it basically does the same. And the end product is a nice area that's vegetated. Okay, next is a solution. And this is a concept that Tony has brought to us. This is ecological bridge concept. This is basically, I see it more as a ladder. You start with the first rung, and the next species will help you get to that. That first species will let you get to that next species, which then again will help you get to the establishment of the final and target species. You can read that right there if you want. I think a lot of you have probably heard about the concept. But I also put it into a, I took one of Tony's graphical representations and put it out so we have cover and years out. So again, the first species you want is a nurse crop. It quickly vegetates the area, but it doesn't persist. And this is one of our lessons learned because we started off with weeping lovegrass and it tended to persist a little bit more than we wanted. So we had to find something else, which we were using winter rye at this point. But again, as you said, it vegetates very quickly and then dies off. The intermediate one would be a fescues. Again, the nurse crop, you know, controls the microclimate to make it a little bit more conducive to the next species. And again, the fescues is that next species. You know, it'll grow and it'll stay a little bit longer, making that, you know, area more conducive for the final and our target crop, which is either hair grass or switchgrass. And again, hair grass, you know, we use that in our bivouacs, firing points, landing zones, because of the last talk, you know, of the talks we've been going about, there's a low maintenance, low growth, or low height species. Switchgrass, we like to use in the more open maneuver areas, because we're not concerned too much about height, but we are concerned about long-term and also about traffic, you know, as long as it can withstand, you know, traffic. The only thing, again, another lesson learned with switchgrass is in the fall, when it goes dormant, it can be a fire hazard. As yet, we haven't seen it happen, but we're thinking in that way that maybe we should, you know, not use switchgrass too much. So our last discussion is in-house. And again, in the beginning, this was many years ago when we were doing this, we used to use an MOA with NRCS. And they used to, we used to make up a contract, send it to them, and we would send them money, and they would do all of our revegetation for us in the same methods that we described. The only thing is we had a few issues with that. First was time. It normally took us a year. By the time that we found the area that we wanted to revegetate, by the time we got the contract together, had all of our signatures on our side done, and gone over the NRCS, had all their signatures done, and then all the signatures for the Jefferson County Soil and Water District, it took almost a year for us to do it. So we couldn't really do it in a very timely manner. And the other thing is cost. We could normally, if we did it with the NRCS, 20 acres, 25 acres, would cost us about $60,000 to do. So what we did is we started using in-house resources. The only problem with that is it takes time to gather that up. You can't really get a crew and equipment together in a short amount of time. So it took us at least 5 years to get the equipment we needed, the tractors, the seeder, stuff like that, and the personnel to be trained up and in order to do it, you know, cheaper and, to tell you the truth, in a timely manner. And it's not just time, but it's also timing. Because say if a unit goes out, there's an exercise, they disturbed an area, we don't want to go right out there and revegetate it, and then the next week have them, somebody else come out. So we have to check on scheduling to make sure that we have a time frame there that it could revegetate. And to tell you the truth, if it was really desperate times, we could shut the area off. We don't like doing that, but it has been done. And in closing, I just want to say thank you to Tony and Tim and even Heidi, who have all been at Fort Drum these many years, helping us to establish our methods of revegetation. So, if anybody has any questions. I guess so. Thank you. Oh, okay, go. Sorry.
The problems with switchgrass, so what are you guys considering or have you started?
I don't think we've really considered anything yet. I think we're still using it, but not as much. And we're also paying attention to where we're doing it. We're not just doing it every place. If we think it's an area that is not going to really be use that often. And again, we can also, because again, the switchgrass is in the maneuver areas. So there's really no ignition source out there, except if the soldiers are bivouacking and they decide to have an open fire, which could start something. You know, a lot of our incidental fires start in the ranges because of tracer rounds, you know, or aerial flares can do that too. But that's why, like, our areas closer to the airport, we may use switchgrass because they're not allowed to use aerial flares in that area. So, and we haven't really figured out what to use in other areas. But we really haven't, our backs aren't to the wall yet with that yet either. So, well, we have time.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.